It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Most sports are all about teamwork, but underwater hockey takes collaboration to new heights, or depths, I should say, since all the action in underwater hockey is at the bottom of a pool. And because players can't hold their breaths very long, hogging the puck is not an option. GPB's Emily Cureton took a little dip with Atlanta's underwater hockey team, the Swordfish. She brought back this audio postcard from a recent practice.
I'm getting my gear out of my bag. I'm Gia Richardson. We have fins, which will help you swim fast underwater. Scuba mask, snorkel. Have sticks, little short sticks that we use to move the puck around.
So the puck is made of lead. It weighs about 3 pounds, so it'll stay on the bottom the whole time.
Andre Savu.
I'm from Canada. The players start at opposite ends of the pool, and so they kind of race the middle to the puck on the bottom. Yep. The pool is pretty much 6 feet, 7 inches all across, and then the idea is you get the puck in, you try to push it all the way to the other opponent's goal. We say sticks up, go, and then we start playing.
All right. Sticks up!
Everything that you did led us to score that goal, okay? Yeah. Good push. Oh.
My name is Ege Akin. I'm in the American national team for this sport. Your breath is the most important thing there is, because you can't play unless you're down there, right? And like, working out for the sport is more about like getting your lungs ready rather than getting like, you know, fit and cut. And like, you see me, like, I don't have any like six packs or like, you know, like biceps or anything, but my lungs inside, they have like 12 packs, you know.
Monica Rojas Peña. It's weird, but once you're playing, it's really fun. It's like kind of like soccer, the same tactics underwater. This team is kind of special. We are like an international team. Some of us came from Georgia Tech, so I came here to do my grad school. I'm from Colombia, from South America. So yeah, and there's people from China, people from Turkish. My husband is from Romania and Canada. Yeah, there's people from everywhere.
My name is Brett Solomano. I used to do free diving back in Australia, and this was the best equivalent for me. It's a nice meditation with a bit of cardio and just, you know, working the whole body, because you're pretty, got to be pretty dynamic under the water. Yeah.
Don't just use your arm, but instead turn your whole body, right? And that's what she did, and that's why she was able to take it.
This sport was made so that free divers could, you know, work out some way. So they had to like make up this weird thing.
They are like, underwater what?
Here I have a reason to swim. I have a reason to hold my breath. And then you don't even notice that you're pushing yourself beyond limits that you think you have, but really you can push yourself past.
Members of the Swordfish Underwater Hockey Club in Atlanta. Their practices are open to players of all levels, and you can see pictures and get more info at gpbnews.org. That piece was produced by GPB's Emily Cureton. Tonight, a documentary showing in Atlanta tells the story of the only Black Puerto Rican one-eyed Jewish entertainer in the world. That's how singer Sammy Davis Jr. used to describe himself. Just ahead, I'll talk with the filmmaker behind the documentary, screening at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. But first, let's hear from Sammy Davis Jr.'s daughter, Tracy. A few years ago, she released a book called Sammy Davis Jr., A Personal Journey with My Father. It's based on conversations the two had as he battled throat cancer toward the end of his life. Through stories and a lot of photos, it captures the extraordinary life of one of the original members of the Rat Pack. I talked with Tracy Davis in 2014 for the NPR show Tell Me More. She told me her father, who entered the entertainment industry at a very young age, did not have a traditional upbringing.
He didn't have the traditional family life. He was always working, 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 and trying to become famous. And then once he was famous, especially in the 60s and 50s before black people could vote, he was scared that it could be taken away at any minute. So he never had that feeling of being able to relax at home. It wasn't until much later, when he was very well established, that he felt like he could take time off.
Tell me the story, if you would, of how they avoided the laws that were meant to keep very young kids off the stage.
My grandfather was doing a black version of vaudeville. And number one, I don't think people cared that much about, you know, small black children, but they billed him as a midget. And they got away with it because no one could believe that someone that small and that young would be that talented.
And he had to wear blackface.
Yes, he did. There's a picture in the book where he's little and he's wearing it, and it just makes me sad. But that's what they did.
I wanted to talk about the song Bojangles. I mean, this is a song that he sang his whole life, and I think he ended most of his concerts with it. And it sounded in the book as though you'd never really known before these conversations what his attachment to that song was. Let's take a listen to a piece of the song first.
I knew a man, Bojangles, and he danced for you. In worn-out shoes, with silver hair, a ragged shirt, and baggy pants. He would do the old soft shoe.
Now, this song is not about the historical, the real Bill Bojangles. It's about somebody else. But your father described it as having a love-hate relationship with the song. What did he mean?
Well, it became a signature classic song for him. And he would, almost every show, end it with that. And people were disappointed if he didn't sing it. He sings it so well because they're not just lyrics for Dad. It really tells a story. He was always afraid that he would end up like that person. That's what was in his heart sometimes. It's like, I don't want to end up like the person in this song. And he thought for a very long time that he would end up like that.
Tell me about his time in the military as well. And obviously, at this point, we're still talking about things that happened before you were born. But there were some really moving stories about not only the racism and the physical violence he faced from his fellow soldiers, but also a man, Sergeant Williams, who really kind of looked out for him and protected him and went above and beyond.
Yeah, as Dad said, sometimes you find real good and real horrible situations. And I know how rough it was for him and how brutally ugly people could be. But then, like you said, there's people that will protect you. He could always sing and entertain, but he learned how to read in the Army, and that was a big deal because he really didn't know how to read.
Sergeant Williams was one of the men that he was thinking of when he talked about the fact that all the way along, despite terrible racism that he encountered his whole life, there were often white men and women who stepped forward to help him out. And also, one of the major ones was Frank Sinatra, with whom he had a lifelong friendship.
Yes, especially Uncle Frank. He did more for Dad than anybody because he knew of Dad, and Dad wanted to go see him perform, and they wouldn't let him in. And that was one of the first times he said, you either let him in and put a table down front for him. And that kind of really was what cemented the friendship. And Frank was the biggest star in the world. And I think Dad was grateful for that his whole life.
Obviously, one of the reasons the Rat Pack was so successful was the rapport between your father and Frank Sinatra. Let's take a listen.
I start off by having you meet Mr. Frank Sinatra. When somebody loves you, it's no good unless she loves you.
Well, if you like him, you're going to be wild about me.
I mean, Frank Sinatra was also the best man at your father's wedding to your mother. And many people may remember what a stir that caused because of this interracial marriage at the time. They postponed their own wedding until after the election at which JFK won the presidency, because Frank Sinatra was going to be the best man, and Frank Sinatra was very closely aligned with JFK's campaign, correct?
Well, first of all, when my mom and dad were dating, Frank was pretending that, you know, mom was his date. That's how they kind of got around, is that mom was his date, not my dad's. And if my mom went to go stay at a hotel, she would stay on one floor and my dad would stay on another floor. And then at night, they'd go stay together and then separate early enough to go back to their respective rooms. And let me just put it this way. I think that my dad was overjoyed that he stood up for them at the wedding. It meant a lot. Then, you know, it became a thing with my father, because after all the campaigning and all the work he did and everything like that, he wasn't invited to the inaugural. And I think that really, dad never got over that. He really felt slighted.
How was it for you then, growing up in an interracial family? All the racism that your father went through, and much of it is detailed in the book, and it's frankly very painful. How much did that touch you as a child?
A lot. You'd come out sometimes, and there was times that a swastika was painted somewhere, or the N-word was written on a car or a windshield or something like that. But they did make a pretty good cocoon for us when we were really little, because most of their friends were in show business or music, where there was less racism in that, because if you had talent, then it didn't really matter. If you could play an instrument or do something or be a good singer or a good actor, they really didn't care. So it kind of gave me a little bit of a false sense of security, and that's probably a good thing, because otherwise I probably would have been more introverted than I actually am.
I wonder if you'd recount what your father had to say about the African-American community. He was obviously upset that some blacks were angry with him. Some blacks called him an Uncle Tom and claimed that he'd sold out in order to please the white community and sell more albums to white people. What was his response to that?
Well, he was hurt, but I don't think that that's anything new for black artists even today. When you get to a certain level, you kind of have to grow your circle. And I think for the black community at that time, they wanted to have a piece of Sammy Davis Jr., and they didn't really understand that he was giving as much as he could give, and it somehow it just didn't seem good enough. You know, to be called names by your own folks is really hurtful, because then where do you go when times are tough, when your own community, a lot of people don't think that you're part of that community anymore? It's a little scary.
And in light of that, it was especially touching when you were talking about your father's 60th anniversary TV special. And Michael Jackson performed the song You Were There. That's a song that Jackson wrote especially for your father,
mm-hmm.
about the way that he broke down barriers for musicians, especially of color. Let's take a listen to that song.
You took the hurt. You took the shame. They built the walls to block your way. You beat them down. You won the day. It wasn't right. It wasn't fair. You taught them all. You made them care. Yes, you were there. And thanks to you, there's now a door we all walk through.
I mean, I gotta say, having read your book, that song even now makes me all verklempt. What was your dad's reaction and yours also?
Well, I think that Michael really loved my father, and he would sneak sometimes to dad's shows and sit on an apple box and on the side of the stage and watch him perform. And dad would say, what are you doing? He goes, I'm just going to steal some of your moves. And he's like, okay. You know, that's what entertainers say all the time. I'm just going to steal some steps. And if anybody has seen that show, if you look at the outpouring of love between the two, if you see my dad's face, because Michael came out to do that just for him and wrote it just for him. And he didn't really, he's not known as a guy that does television specials. So it was really moving for dad. And it was moving for me too. He's just really respectful of my dad. And I always appreciated that.
So your father said to you during these conversations, just don't let me die here.
Yes.
What did that mean to you?
What it meant was keep me alive, not only in your heart or in our family, but he wanted to have a legacy. He wanted to be remembered and thought about. I have these memories and I cherish them, and I've ran into so many people, and I still do now when they find out who Dad is, and they'll start asking me questions and whatever, and that makes me feel good that he's still remembered.
So during the whole book, it was a question of whether or not your father would make it long enough to see the birth of his first grandchild, and he did.
Yes.
I wonder now, with your children all these years later, after, as you say, with the grace of time, what is it that you most want to pass on to your family about what you learned from your father?
I think that one of the things I learned from Dad is that even though he went through all those tough racism times and everything, hatred fades, and you bring it up to talk about it, so hopefully you change somebody's mind. Maybe you won't, but maybe they'll take a softer stance. And what I try and teach my kids is the patience that Dad had for the world, but also the love that he had for people, for his job, for his family, and that he didn't, you know, I'm living in the South right now, and sometimes there's still incidents that come up, and you just say to yourself, hello, 2014, and people don't understand that it's still there. So, you know, every once in a while, there's still a little fight left in me, and I try and teach my kids that.
That's Tracy Davis, the daughter of singer Sammy Davis Jr. A documentary about her father's life shows tonight at the Atlanta Jewish Film Festival. Just ahead, I talk with the Emmy Award-winning filmmaker behind that documentary. This is On Second Thought.
Don't go to bed with no price on your head. No.
Don't do it.
No, no. Don't do the crime if you can't do the time.